The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If this is your first time listening, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique.
And this time we speak to Jane Ashworth. Jane is the author of A Kind of Intimacy, A Cold Light, Notes Made When Falling, and her most recent novel, Ghosted, A Love Story. She has won a Betty Trask Award and been listed as one of the UK's 12 best new writers.
Yeah, so Jen joined us sometime in early autumn, I think it was, of 2021, during the sort of downtime that she gets from teaching creative writing at Lancaster University.
Yeah, we started talking about moving from downtime into uptime and how she manages her time to get the most from writing, which she has quite a structured approach, I think, which is quite interesting.
I think, as you'll hear, she was joining us on a Thursday, and in the Thursday mornings when she's been writing all the way through lockdown, she's been joining another group of writers where they have 2 hours where they work on their project. What that work means and what the definition of work is, as you will hear, is something that is open to interpretation for everyone taking part.
It sounded like it had grown from something that came from necessity in lockdown to something that was kind of quite an important part of the week for Jen these days. And it also built on her experience with 100 Days of Writing, which she'd sort of implemented a few years ago, I think. I don't know when it started. I think
maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, she mentioned there'd been 100 days of other activities, but she sort of ported that over to writing and introduced via Instagram, I think, mainly, but on social media too.
Yeah, and I mean, her sort of way of looking at it was that just making yourself turn up every day for 100 days. I mean, you'll hear all about this, but it's not about saying I'm going to do 500, 1,000 words every day. It's about turning up, looking at what you're working on, and then doing that for 100 days. I've used this approach myself. I was in the editing stage, but it worked really well. I think I can highly recommend it. Jen also has a couple of excellent tips that she gives us, so look out for them.
And we give you Jen Ashworth.
What's your sort of balance between the teaching side of creative writing and the writing side?
It's uneven. So we have short terms. There are about the 10 weeks, the terms. And during those 10 weeks, I get about a day a week for my writing. And the rest of it is teaching prep, kind of managing courses. There's a fair bit of admin, other things. Although in the vacations, which is, I guess, the rest of the time, it kind of flips on its head. And I would say I'm writing about 4 days a week. And the other time, it's kind of course prep, teaching prep, seeing PhD students who carry on all year round. So long as I can kind of plan around term times, it works pretty well. And in that 10-week period, there is a lot of flexibility, so I can't rearrange my teaching, but I can rearrange various meetings to make room for other things. It feels like a good job to combine with writing for me.
With your sort of regular writing day, is that always the same day of the week?
It depends on my teaching timetable, and we get the teaching timetable kind of not too long before term starts. And so when I get that timetable, I put all my seminars and lectures in my diary, and I have a look at what is the regular day a week that I've got free. It can change. But it's Thursday this term. So today is a writing day. So this morning I met up with a writing group that I work with. We started in lockdown, and we all kind of log on to Microsoft Teams and say, well, here's what I'm going to be working on this morning. And then turn cameras off, go away and write for a couple of hours, and then come back and say, here's how it went. That seems to work really well. It sounds like really simple, but it's actually quite nice to have the accountability and have the company. So I'll be doing that every Thursday this term, and that fits in quite well. And then I have the afternoons to myself.
So do you sort of read out stuff you've written, or do you just discuss?
We don't, as a rule, read things out, although I think occasionally someone will email something round and say, you know, that thing I've been talking about for the last 8 weeks, this is it, I'm done. I swapped an essay with one of the other members of the group last week because we were both wanting another opinion. But it's not a workshop, and I don't know quite why that is, because it's not as if I don't believe getting feedback on work is useful, and I give feedback on work all the time, and I find the giving of feedback quite useful for me as a writer as well. But I think what we all needed when we set this up, which was in the darkest bit of lockdown, was not kind of feedback or criticism or suggestions on work. We just needed some space and some encouragement, I guess. So So that is what that is for. And even though we're not as locked down or as isolated as we were, and we're all teachers, and even though the teaching is a little, you know, we're back in the classroom now, so it's a bit more familiar the way we're doing it, a bit easier for the students. So even though the pressures are not as horrendous as they were, I think we're still finding it really useful just to check in and say, here's what I'm doing, here's what I'm going to spend the next 2 hours working on. It feels really simple, but yeah, really great as well.
So you have a team meeting before writing and then afterwards as well. Do you have a sort of format in terms of what topics you talk about in the first session and the second? And
not at all. It's really, really informal. And I think that's because when we set it up, we were all just so stretched and so, you know, in such low ebb. I mean, I speak for myself primarily, but really struggling to find time for the writing and struggling to, I don't know, to feel okay about spending time on writing when there was so much other stuff going on that felt quite urgent and quite important. And so although we didn't plan it this way, what we did in that space is really, really low pressure. So there's no agenda. You literally just turn up and you say, here is, you know, maybe we spend about 10, 15 minutes and we go around and each person takes a turn and says, here's what I plan to do this morning. And sometimes it's editing, sometimes it is writing new work, sometimes it's researching. We're not all fiction writers, so the process is quite different. If someone's having a particular problem, that might be what they say at the beginning. You know, I plan to try and have a go at this thing I've been finding very difficult. And then we go away for a couple of hours, and then we open up the meeting again at the end and spend another, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes just saying, here's what I did, here's what it felt like. We don't tend to say, here's what I achieved, or here is the way in which I was productive, or here's how many thousand words I wrote. It's more about what the process was like in that couple of hours.
Would that include things like the, you know, what you actually wrote about, the plot, the characters? I sort of moved this character on to the scene.
Definitely. Or if it was an essay and we were struggling to make a connection between a couple of different topics, or I remember once I was on a deadline, and it was for an essay, and I said, I've been putting off doing the references for weeks because it's really boring and I can't make myself do it. And I'm going to spend this 2 hours. This is my 2 hours. I'm going to do it. I'm going to finish it. That's it. And so, yeah. And sometimes it can be really exploratory work, really very creative work. And there's no rule really about what you use the time for.
Do you find you do tend to stick to what you sort of lay out in the first 10, 15 minutes? Like if you say, I'm going to do these references, do you tend to come back 2 hours later and that is what you've spent 2 hours on? Or does it kind of shift, or you come back 2 hours later and said, well, actually, the references are for another day. I just started writing something completely different. And
I think we're all really different. I know that for the first few weeks when we started doing this, I would say, do you know what? I really want to use this time to start generating some ideas for a new novel, or I've got some ideas and I want to do some free writing. And after we all logged off, I'd sit there and realise that I just really, really didn't want to. And yet it was still useful because I thought, I've got these 2 hours. What do I want to do? So sometimes I would write letters to my friends or check in with other people about their writing or do a bit of reading. It just felt, you know, Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way, and she's got this idea of having the artist's date. there's some things about that book that I really don't love, and I'm not sure that any of us would call what we were doing the artist's date. But that idea of having some time that is not for email, not for Twitter, not for working their way down the to-do list, even if we don't do exactly what we said we were going to do, is still pretty useful. And I guess it must be because we're all still doing it. And I think we intended that it would be something we'd do for maybe a term, just 10 weeks. And we've been doing it now well over a year.
I think it's quite good to have that specific time as well, because it's the, when your to-do list or, you know, the house never looks cleaner is when, say, with a whole day to do it. Whereas if you're, and you've tied yourself to other people.
I think it's that combination of the accountability for other people and does have a really interesting relationship with the to-do list, because if your to-do list is full of things like, I don't know, write this lecture, go to the supermarket, clean the oven, and then you've got one thing on it that says write a novel, of course you're going to clean the oven. Like, of course you are, because, you know, it'll take you an hour and you're done and you can tick it off and you can feel great and you might not have to do it again for another month or whatever. And if every day you sit down and say, I'm going to write a novel, every day you won't have done and you'll feel crap about it. And so it makes the job, today's to-do list is to sit with my friends for 2 hours and I'll think about my writing for a bit and I will not do anything except my writing, whatever that looks like to me. And I can tick it off and, you know, not feel like a failure for not writing my novel.
You sound very sort of motivated by having specific periods and chunks. So I wanted to ask you about the 100 days of writing, which is obviously quite a different thing to the 2 hours. But you're the person who introduced me to that across social media. But I don't know if that was that an idea you got from someone else or something you came up with?
I think that there are other people who run 100 days of doing something projects, and the reason I know this is because when I use the hashtag, if you write 100 days, other things come up, like 100 days of gardening, or there's a good one that I want to join and it's called 100 days of eyeshadow. I'm a fan. 100 days of screenwriting, 100 days of, I don't know, practicing my cello. So I don't think the concept that you do something every day for 100 days is mine. I'm not aware of anyone doing 100 days of writing specifically in the way that I did it before me. So when it started, I was, I think about halfway through the final draft or version of Notes Made While Falling, which is a book of a memoir in essays that I was writing. And I was at a very difficult point in that book and someone close to me in my family died. And I'd never had a difficulty with writing before. I had difficulty finding the time and writing itself was difficult, but I never had the time and sat down and was unable to do anything. And I think it was because I took a long break. I took a few weeks off around the bereavement and I didn't know how to go back. And just totally spontaneously, I thought, I'm going to turn up every day for 100 days and see what happens. And I think that my ambition, my secret ambition was, in 100 days, I will finish this book. I will have it done. And I posted about it on Instagram just very spontaneously. I didn't really have any plan. But what happened without my planning was that loads of other people got involved and started posting every day. And I think that what I learned during that first 100 days of writing really influenced how I went on to do it. So I learned that when it comes to writing novels, the process and the difficulties in the process didn't really feel that different from the way that writers of other forms were describing how it was for them. So there were screenwriters, there were poets, there were people working on PhDs, academic books, non-fiction. And because we were all concentrating on process, I realised that I could learn a lot from writers in other forms and genres. And I also learned this boot campy type feel of, we're going to turn up every day, whether you feel like it or not, or, you know, we're going to pump the words out. The violence of that just didn't work for me at all. But that having a discipline to turn up every day meant I could be very gentle. So if some days turning up, it meant opening the Word document and sighing heavily and running the spell check. Or sometimes I remember once I was in the car on the way to Brighton and I marked up some edits on a manuscript for about half an hour and that was it. Because I knew that I was definitely going to turn up tomorrow, it meant that I could be really gentle and do a half-assed job of it today and not feel guilt. And it also meant I got more done than if I was saying to myself, you have to write 1,000 words every day, or you have to sit in your chair for 3 hours every day. Because for me and for a lot of the writers that I was joining in with me, that's not possible. For lots and lots of reasons, it's just not possible. And it doesn't matter if you try really hard or force yourself or stop watching telly or sleeping. It's just not possible. And so because I learned those things and because it was so useful, I did it a few more times and it kind of evolved a little bit. And it taught me something new every time I did it.
Was that quite a change from the way that you'd written before then? It sounds as though you sort of had an instinctive feeling to sort of have a structure around your writing. But was there a big change and you were approaching things in a completely different way before?
Yeah, I think so. I think I had always been imagining that I could force myself to be a better writer. That was possible, that the part of me that did the writing, I could kind of batter it into being more productive and more talented and cleverer and more successful, and that the way I would achieve what I wanted to achieve with my writing was with brute force. And so I was very interested in books and blogs and podcasts and things about productivity, and really interested in to-do lists and schedules. And, you know, for some people that stuff really works. And if it does, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. What I learned was that when things were going quite wrong in my life and when I was at low ebb, that didn't work. And I also realized that for most of a writer's life, there will be other stuff happening. You know, the kids will get ill, or you need to work for money, or you get dumped, or I don't know, there's practical difficulty, there's emotional difficulty, and that doesn't go away. So what changed was, instead of trying to browbeat me into being better or browbeat my life into being more predictable and conducive to writing, there was just a very, very gentle, we're just going to turn up every day and see what happens. That was it. That was the only rule. Very interested in habit and in routine. And it seemed to me that this moment of routine, the commitment just to turn up every day, nothing else, not turn up every day and write for 2 hours or write 1,000 words or write something brilliant, just turn up. That's it. That it was for me and for lots of other people who joined in, exactly the right sweet spot between discipline and freedom, or habit and gentleness. That's what I discovered. There were lots of people who started and stopped because writing every day wasn't possible for them. And I also want to mention that there was lots of people who started and adapted 100 days to turn it into 200 days because they were writing every other day, or that for them the commitment would be that they would do 20 minutes every Sunday afternoon or whatever. And for the writers who needed to radically adjust that because of their, some writers who are writing alongside disability or chronic pain or in ill health or are carers, that they made those adjustments but still really kept faithful to the spirit of the thing, which is when you say you're going to turn up, you do, and that's enough. So yeah, I kind of really wanted to mention that because that was something that I didn't know and that I learned from people who did it with me.
It's quite important that you share, I mean, I'm not going to say the failures, but the days where it's difficult.
Yeah.
Days, because a lot of social media does seem to be about projecting quite an alternative reality to suggest that everything is easy and everything straightforward. But I think that's really important. And when we have our discussions about what a writer is and stuff, I think people get ideas about what you have to be doing to qualify as being legit. I think I remember like Hilary Mantel or someone being asked about whether she wrote every day, and she said, yeah, of course. It's, you know, that puts a lot of pressure on people. They think, well, that's what I need to be doing, otherwise I'm a failure or I'm not.
Yeah, I think I didn't plan this, but as I look back and I reflect on it, I think the fact that I've recorded it on Instagram turned out to be quite important because I would often take pictures of where I was when I was doing the writing, and that people could see that I was quite ordinary, you know, and there wasn't this kind of mystique of the writer. There wasn't, I don't know, like a Garrett and a typewriter and a packet of Lucky Strike and a bucket, you know, a bottle of whiskey. There wasn't any of that stuff, you know. Sometimes I was in bed eating Pringles, and sometimes I was in the car because my kids were at a swimming lesson, and sometimes I was in the library, and sometimes I was at my desk and it looked lovely and I had a nice candle. And that all of those things, I guess that was the thing about 100 Days of Writing. It was about developing a practice that was flexible enough to accommodate an ordinary life. And for lots of us, that includes paid work, it includes children or other people that we care for, it includes the toilet leaking. And that those domestic circumstances, the material circumstances in which we all write, felt as important to the project. And yeah, this idea of failure as well, that I didn't ever say I wrote this many words, but I would say, here's how I feel about what I've done today. And today I'm really pleased, I think it's great. And at other times I'd say, oh, I feel terrible about it, or I'm bored, or it's boring, and I bet Virginia Woolf didn't have to deal with this, and how dare you compare yourself to Virginia Woolf, and all that stuff that goes on. The more I did that, the more I realised that that's quite an unusual thing for a writer to do. I think quite often our public lives, and or as they are lived on social media, are about selling the work or selling the idea of being a writer. And I was not really interested in that. I wanted to know people and for them to know me. It was quite a very old-fashioned and idealistic way of using social media.
Through that process, have you found any difference in the way that you sort of get into the work on a daily basis? Have you found it easier to sort of start or pick up where you left off? Do you have any tricks or processes to kind of go from being in a zone where you're not writing with, you know, kids, yeah, or paid work or the toilet leaking, and then okay, you've got the time set to write? Do you have any sort of steps that you go through to get in the zone to start writing, or do you find it varies from day to day?
It does vary. And that transition between whatever else it is you are doing into the writing, I find difficult. It's quite difficult because I do most of my writing on the computer, and a lot of the other kinds of work that I do are also on the computer. And quite a lot of the other ways that I procrastinate from work are also on the computer. So there's something about this little box that is quite difficult and remains difficult. And what helped was, if you're doing something every day 100 times, you figure out quite quickly what your habits are and what are the helpful habits and what are the unhelpful habits. So what I would really like is to be the kind of writer who, I don't know, gets up in the morning and has a quiet coffee while looking out of the window and flicking through a quality broadsheet, and then having a nice walk and then sitting down to the writing. And that's not the kind of writer I am at all. And I have tried to bludgeon myself into being that kind of writer. I'm not a morning person. I tend to work really well if I have interrupted the work yesterday at a good place. This is a tip, I guess, I would give, that if it's going really well, stop.
Just stop.
Stop in the middle of a sentence. Stop when you know what is coming next. That helps. Another thing that I learned was that if I say to myself, on Thursday I'm going to do some writing, it's a kind of invitation for me to spend Thursday pissing around. Whereas if I say, at 9:30 on Thursday, I am going to edit the last two sections of this essay and then email it. And then, you know, after we speak, I know exactly what I'm going to do. I've got it written down. So I put a time, I make myself an appointment, and I'm quite specific about the thing I'm doing. So I don't write, 4:30, write your novel. But I do write 4:30 to 6:30 is the time that I'm going to be working on this particular scene that I'm curious about. And I write that down in my diary. Those are things that really help me. And rewards as well. I bribe myself. So I often have loads of sweets or crisps and stuff at the table. I don't know if I recommend that to everyone because we'll probably all die of heart attacks. But I don't know, like a little bag of sweets is never a bad thing, is it?
Thinking about the writing essays when I was an undergraduate and I would have the worst kind of like sour Haribo sweets.
Oh, yes. I wonder if Hilary Mantel pays herself in Pringles and aniseed balls to get to the end of a chapter. She may well do, you know. I think another trick or another help that I discovered while doing the 100 Days of Writing was if there's a problem, if I'm stuck, I can use a writing session trying to describe what the problem is, as if I'm going to speak to someone else about it, to try and figure out to physically write it, what is the problem I am having? And sometimes I'm stuck and I don't know why I'm stuck. And that feels pretty terrifying. But once I have identified that this is, I don't know enough about this setting to describe it accurately, or the connection between this idea and this idea is unclear, or this character's dialogue is boring because I have no idea what his motivation is in this scene, immediately the answer to the problem suggests itself immediately. And that problem may not fix itself for weeks, but if I know what it is, it's much less scary. So that is another good thing. I struggle sometimes with being bored. And there are two things that I do when I am bored. And one is that I write about being bored and figure out what it is about the project that is boring to me. And the other thing that I do is I just skip the boring bit, and I don't write in order, so I just think, oh, I'm not in the mood for writing this today, I'm going to skip forward to the bit I'm excited about.
Do you have a plan in your head then? Do you have a structure before you sort of sit pen to paper for a novel? Do you sort of know, oh, this bit's coming up and these things have to happen first, but you can or can't jump from it?
No, I very rarely write in order, and I don't really know how to do plot. Plot is kind of the outcome of characters interacting with each other in interesting ways. And so what I will often have is a list of scenes or moments that I am quite excited about writing, and I don't know how they relate to each other in time. And I write them I'm just going to show you some. I write them just on little bits of paper, and they just lie about on my desk. And there might be one that I really want to write, and I put it in my diary. Or maybe like on the day, I just pick one and think, oh, I fancy doing that. That's a first draft. It gets a little more, the work becomes different in a second or a third draft when it is my job to put these things in order and to think about the connections and to think about the reader a bit more. But in a first draft, I'm just finding out what it is that makes me excited about it.
Hey, what you reading for?
This is where the benefit of reading comes into play.
Looks like we got ourselves a reader.
Those bits of paper, are you writing them primarily in the hours that you've set aside to write? Or are you creating those all through the day in the middle of cooking?
Yeah, I always have post-its about my person on every desk, on every table, and I just, other companies making little bits of paper are available, bits of old envelope, anything like that. And they just follow me around the house like leaves, and I am not very careful with them. There's probably a few down the side of my bed. There will be some in my bag almost certainly, and they get mixed up. I put this on my Instagram a few weeks ago, but I've got one here that says plant food, clothes area, good frying pan. And I got it off off my desk, and I thought, oh, I wonder what this was about. This is quite exciting. And I realised it was a shopping list. So I'm not particularly precious when it comes to collecting the material, because I trust that if the post-it will appear on my desk at some point, or I'll remember it if I need it.
Do you have a phase of sort of filing the
post-it? No.
If you can, did you collect them, start to see, oh, this is taking shape into some kind of larger story, or have completely diverse post-its from shopping lists
all over the place, and it's a horrible mess. And I have some here. You see, some are index cards and some are bits of paper. but they're not in any order. They're just sort of thoughts. And it's funny because I have to be really careful because I'm so tight, I'm using the backs of ones that I've written on before. And so some of these scenes are actually from Ghosted, and I have to make sure that I'm looking on the right side of the post-it. Otherwise, I'll start rewriting the novel that I wrote 2 years ago without knowing. No, it's very disorganized, and the disorder is useful. It's useful because I'm just following in the first draft. My job is not to write a novel. It is to follow my pleasure until there are about a novel's worth of words in the document. And the editing is when I need to write a novel. I need to turn that into something else. But if I think of doing that too early, it becomes very boring and then I don't want to do it.
So what level of development is it at the end of a first draft for you then? Is it...
It's horrible.
Okay, so would it still have kind of notes and some bullet-pointed bits of ideas?
And the characters would change names and genders and ages, and there will be bits with square brackets that say... I don't know. Find out about how quickly a body rots and fix this scene later. And sometimes I will put notes to myself like, this is bad. I don't know why. Do you know why? Find this out. Like, you know, notes to my future self. Yeah. It's not anything that I could take to a workshop or to show anyone. It's like instructions for a novel rather than a novel itself. And I guess when I knew that about my process, it began to feel much, much better because I think that I thought that people sat down and typed and it was more or less like a finished book. And it took a lot of time kind of teaching and seeing the diversity of the first draft and the third draft and how boldly that they can change to realise that the way I was doing it, it kind of wasn't wrong.
Yeah, I think doing this podcast, we've realised there are big varieties to that, and that some people do have a first what they would consider a first draft, which is, you know, to all intents and purposes a novel. But I think we were speaking to someone quite recently, and this is something I really go along with, who's referred to their first draft as a kind of zero draft, getting the material together, which I think is...
Sometimes I think in the first draft I'm like digging clay out of the soil. I'm just getting my material. That's all I'm doing. And then this big lump, this 80,000 word mass of horror, then I start writing. Then, you know, I enjoy the exploration and the playfulness of the first draft and the way that you can write down anything and it doesn't matter. But I really, really like editing because I think it uses a really different part of my brain, and it allows me to find the novel in the mess I made, which is difficult in a different way.
And does that often feed back to, do you find that within all the post-it notes that then become the first draft, there is a sort of a key post-it note, a sort of lodestone that is actually that's where the novel is. That's the center of it. And you had that written down all along, or is it?
Yeah, it's like that. It is. So, and I don't think I always know it at the time. So for Fel, I wrote a scene and I was so excited to write this scene, and it was the one where Jack and Nettie, who are the main characters, the mum and dad, are there with their little girl Annette, and they're at Grangeover Sans Lido, and it is summer 1963, and they bump into this boy who, for some unknown reason, takes it upon himself to heal Jack's short-sightedness. And he immediately says, oh, you must come and have Sunday dinner with us, because his wife is dying. And I thought it would be a short story, and I wrote it, and that was the first scene that I wrote, and it became almost like Mary Poppins's carpet bag. And whenever I was stuck, I went back to this scene and thought, what is interesting about this? What is interesting? And to me, what was really interesting was all these questions of character, like, why does he not tell her that his wife? Why does he not tell Tim that his wife is dying? Why does he want Tim to touch him again? What does the daughter think is happening when she sees this and she doesn't know her mother is ill? Every time I went back to that scene, I had a question, and it would spark another scene, and I would write it, and then eventually a novel kind of came together. And it was like that with Ghosted too. The very first thing I wrote was the first three or four pages. That was the first thing. I had a woman speaking direct camera almost, right to the reader, saying, this is what happened the last time I saw my husband. It was all really very ordinary. And I didn't tell the police I was angry at him, but I'm telling you now. Every time I got stuck or I didn't know what to do next, I would go back to that scene and there would be something about it that would make me curious for me to go and write the rest of the book.
When you move from the first draft to the second draft, in sort of practical sense, how do you, once you're trying to marsh it all into a novel by that point, do you completely rewrite it from scratch or do you edit the material you've got?
I read recently, is it Sarah Moss? She writes the first draft and then she deletes it, totally deletes it, and then starts again and just works from memory. I really admired the courage and the confidence and that kind of commitment. And also, I was kind of horrified, really horrified. So I don't do that. I'll tell you what I'll do, and it is extremely unglamorous, but it does work for me. So I have the first draft, and one of the things I find really difficult about writing novels is that they're so big and long, and it's very difficult to work with that amount of material. When you make a tiny change in chapter 2, it means that chapter 10 doesn't work anymore, and to hold all that in your head. So I kind of shrink the first draft into a kind of blueprint, or I write a synopsis of what I have. So, and it's a list of scenes, and that's synopsis A. And I use that. I don't look at the first draft. I look at the synopsis of the first draft to try and find what the novel should be. And then I write another synopsis, which is the novel that I wish I'd written, or the novel that I think I should have written after reading my draft. And the gap between synopsis A and synopsis B immediately suggests tasks. So I'm going to ask you now to just bear with me, because this is so, I'm a bit embarrassed to tell you actually, but these tasks, I write a list of what they are. And I also, so I'm really, really specific about them. And there might be like 300 of them. And I also estimate how long each of these tasks will take me. And then I put all that on a spreadsheet and give them all a number. And then I schedule all the numbers into my diary. And that is how I go from the mess of the first draft to something like the second draft that looks better. But I often have to do this synopsis A, synopsis B, that generates a load of tasks that I put a time on and schedule into my diary. I have to do that maybe 4 or 5 times, because I do lots of drafts as well.
I guess that can be quite a significant change between synopsis A and synopsis B.
Massive, yeah, massive. And I might not do the tasks in order. I try and almost triage them so that there's a difference between moving the whole thing 30 years in the past and fixing this paragraph where a character's eyes change colour. And if I'm just moving from draft 1 to draft 2, I'm probably not interested in the copy or the sentences, that level of editing. It's generally bigger structural type stuff. But as I go into draft 4 and 5, the tasks that are on my list are much, much more the closer work. And it's a really different way of writing to the first draft, which is just play and messing around with post-its and don't consider the reader at all. It's much more focused. And I felt a bit embarrassed when I was telling you, and I think it's because if I tell you, oh, I'm messy and I'm wandering around with post-its in my pockets all the time and it's a bit of a mess, that may be what we think a creative person should be like. There's something about that chaos and that playfulness. But if I say, oh, and I've also got a spreadsheet and it's full of numbers, and in my diary it says task 47, and I go to the spreadsheet and there's a description of what that task is, and I already know how long I've allowed for it, it sounds like I'm running a bank or, I don't know, some kind of quantity surveyor type task.
I think there is a lot of mythology around this, isn't there? I don't think it's useful a lot of times. I think a lot of people have those sort of ideas in their head.
But it takes both. Like I somehow have stumbled on a process so far that allows me to be a bit flaky and playful and indulgent and have a lot of fun and sit with my post-its and stuff myself with sweets. And my writing requires that. And it also requires quite a lot of focus and organisation and good you know, project management skills. And it's because I want to finish things and I want to be able to meet deadlines and I want to make something that someone else is going to, you know, like now and again.
Do you find that your estimates for the tasks are quite accurate? Does that give you a, I mean, obviously the accuracy of your estimates will change over time, but do you generally know how long a novel is going to take until it's getting towards the tidying up side of editing?
No, I'm always wrong about that. Always. And I always have to go, oh, job 47, do it in an hour and a half. And then I work for an hour and a half and I realise job 47 isn't finished. So I reschedule it. So it's kind of a fake way of getting it into my diary and making me feel okay about the massive amount of work there is. I'm better at estimating than I used to be. I am. I know my process a bit better. And I control how long a task takes. So in the earlier drafts, if one of the tasks is something like improve the dialogue in chapter 2, 4 hours, and I sit and I do it for 4 hours, well, of course, I could do it for another 10 hours if I wanted, but 4 hours is how long I've allowed for it. So I go on for that draft. It might be when I do another draft, I want to go back and do some more work on that. So there's a bit of a combination, I think, of it being just a trick to get me to do the work, but also quite important limitation to stop me tinkering for days and days on end and to keep me moving.
For the more structural sort of changes, like when you're going from the first draft to the second draft, and are you making sort of big changes that you ever kind of have to just delete everything and rewrite it from scratch? You're like, okay, that whole section, it's got to go in the bin and start again, because now that I've changed it in this way, it just doesn't work.
Yeah. And sometimes I'm writing new work right at the end, like right before I'm submitting it, I'm writing new work. But that tends to be the novel has shown me what the new work needs to be. So it's not like the first draft. I know that I need a scene in chapter 5 that explains why this guy hates his brother. And it would be great if it could be set in a cafe because it introduces this space that the reader's going to see later. So I know what the function of it is going to be, so it's a lot easier to write. But yeah, I will be writing new stuff right up until the end and deleting stuff as well. It's like juggling with jellyfish that hate you. That's what it's like.
I always love the writing that comes, yeah, that say in the sixth draft or something, you realize there needs to be a scene just to do something. And you never have to start from so far back. It's so fluent and it fits because you've got everything warmed up. You know the atmosphere, you know all the rules, you know what has integrity in that world. And it's really dispiriting that you couldn't just start afresh on a new project with all that.
I know. I think some people do. I think they plan. I think they do. You will have, you know, spoken to writers, but they plan, they research, they devise a structure so that when they sit down, even for their first draft, they know what the function is. They know why they're writing each scene. And I don't, I think that planning happens when I'm messing around with my post-its. I think that is planning for me and I can't seem to think about it separately from doing it. And some people can. And I spoke to loads of writers about this, and I think we can change our process and tweak our process and make experiments, and that quite often if we're having a problem with the work, the problem might not be with our talent or with the idea, it might be with process, and I do believe that. But I have never been able to train, as a teacher, I've never been able to teach someone who works like me to be a planner or to teach a planner to work the way I do. I just wonder if it's, I don't like having blue eyes or brown eyes, and we are all perfect the way that God has made us. I don't know.
I also think there's part of it is that just how much work goes into making a novel. And I'm sure, like, you could say that about other art forms as well, but you've got now to find the way that works for you to get it done. And it's so many different strategies. Because I think you were saying about, and this is something I can really get on board with, about when you've got a bit that you're bored with and you can go on and do something else and sort of leave that for later. I feel like your kind of project management system allows you to do that with the task as well. So you could say, okay, I'm not feeling that right now, but I'll definitely be making forward progress if I do a selection of these other tasks.
Yeah. And because I know what I'm like, I can have a list of tasks on the go and I know which ones play to my strengths and I know which ones I don't really want to do. And if I've got a happy day and a high energy day and I'm feeling like a bit of a genius, I might do the stuff that is difficult. But there's always something on my list that's like the writerly equivalent of, I don't know, hoovering. And you can, you know, even if it's a very bad day, you can run the Hoover around, can't you? And there's stuff like that on my list that means I progress. And I do think one of the special difficulties of novels is not only the amount of words, the hugeness of them, or the time scales that we're working with in terms of the plot and the character development, but also how long they take to write. And that means that we have to be very tolerant to the project being bad for a very long time. I don't doubt that poets, that short story writers and flash fiction writers write bad first drafts and bad sixth drafts. I'm sure that's true too. But they're kind of not sitting in the nastiness of their own filth for 3 years. And I am, and I need special help with that, which is where all these spreadsheets and piles of sweeties and post-its and all this other stuff come in. It's maybe it doesn't help the novel. It maybe it just helps me tolerate the novel being unfinished for so long.
And do you find that when you get into the later sort of draft four, moving to draft five, do you have a different note-taking? Are you still writing on the same post-its, even when it's a very specific task, like add this sentence at the end of this paragraph on this page of this draft? You know, it's not the same, I presume, as a post-it note that's a very general idea for a scene. Do you try and keep those in a different way?
Yeah, I might make a note on my phone or a note on a post-it, but it is very much for the spreadsheet. Like the spreadsheet holds everything. And it's like my brain, and it means that I don't have to use my brain for that.
So you'd be adding in notes to expanding on, you have the various numbered tasks and then adding new cells, like within this task also do this.
And we get like, so I might number the tasks 1 to 300, but then I put things in like, I don't know, 300A or 97B part 3, and it becomes like this House of Leaves style horrible document. But it means that my brain doesn't have to do any of that, and I don't need to think about that, and I don't need to worry about it. And the single thing that I need to do when I sit down at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon is figure out if Kevin's roses are pink or yellow all the way through the book. And I just sit and do that, and then I know I have been a novelist for that day. I don't need to think about anything else.
What sort of stage are you at the moment? So you did your 2 hours of writing, or 2 hours of working today. Whereabouts are you in this process?
So this morning I was finishing an essay, and I am late to some, and I have submitted it today, but it was late. It is for a creative nonfiction journal, and I've been working on it for a couple of months now, and I was over the word count, and I sent it to two friends, and they both gave me some really interesting suggestions, and they didn't agree with each other, which was also really useful. And so this morning I was cutting the essay and preparing it to be submitted, and it felt really good. I felt like I had a really clear idea about what was essay and what wasn't essay. And the stuff that I was cutting, I could see it was like it had another essay growing out of its back, like an ear on a genetically modified mouse. And I kind of cut that off, and I'll deal with the ear some other time. I'll put it in a petri dish and grow something new out of it. But that's done. And then this afternoon, I want to be writing a novel, and I've just got loads of these and I'm post-its, and I'm going to make some more post-its this afternoon. I'm going to spend a little bit of time doing that, because I have had some train journeys over the past couple of days, and they seem to make my brain work. So that's what I'm going to do. And I hope that it's a novel, but it's not yet.
And were you writing post-it notes while you were on the train journeys?
No, I was thinking I wish I had my post-its and a table when I was on the train. So all of that's in there, and it needs to come out, and I have them ready.
Yeah, so you don't have to do the holding it in your brain anymore.
I think this is something I am learning from this conversation, that most of my planning process involves getting stuff out of my brain and deputizing the thinking or the worrying or the remembering to some form of technology so that when I write, I just need to do sentences.
I mean, I think in a sort of fundamental way, that is what writing is about. It's getting it out of your brain and using a, you know, even if the tool is just a piece of paper.
Yeah, but there's something to me about getting the worry or the planning out of my brain, and I know my spreadsheet is taking care of it, which means that I can sit down and the single thing I need to think about is how would I describe X. It just makes that one task so much easier, hopefully.
I don't know how if you ever get that sort of mid conversation with someone and you suddenly start thinking, because I'm quite a distracted person who also has their other writing projects while I'm trying to live a normal life and function big, and you sort of think, I could just write this down while they're talking to me about what happened when they were at the shop. But
we're always, I think, was it Rowan Bart? He said that the writer was a truant, that when we're working, we're always on holiday thinking about something else, and when we're on holiday, we're always secretly working, that it splits us into lots of different people. And yeah, I talk to Siri when I'm on my way to work sometimes in the car. I say, Siri, just take a note of this. I feel like Agent Cooper from Twin Peaks. The stuff goes in my phone and I can be talking to my partner sometimes, or he's talking to me and he looks at me and goes, are you writing right now? Is that what's happening? I'm like, yes, it is. And like distraction is focus for a writer, I think.
Yeah, I do think if you live with non-writers, they do start to be able to see the signs after a while and can tell when the vehicle's moving, but you know, the driver's not necessarily paying attention.
I watched this documentary, it was one of those Imagine programs on the BBC iPlayer. I don't know if it's still up there, but it was Ian Rankin. His process is really, really interesting. So he takes, like, you know, Christmas and New Year off, but during that time he's thinking, what will my next novel be? Because he always starts in January, and he's got a folder of newspaper clippings. So he always starts. He always starts in January, which is quite a nice, and he writes a novel every year, and he wants to get the first draft of it, or a good draft of it, off to his editor by September so that he can get all the edits done before Christmas and take Christmas off. And they're interviewing his wife, and she takes a holiday every year, like late March, Easter time, because apparently at that point in his process, he's always unbearable. And she just goes away.
Flinging typewriters.
I mean, I don't know. I don't remember in which ways he was unbearable. I'm sure he's a lovely human being in every way, but she was very clear that at this point of the year and his writing process, she was going to take a holiday. And I know that. So I don't write as seasonally as that, but I know that around 40,000 words of the first draft, it's like setting off in a boat, and at 40,000 words, you don't see land behind you or in front of you. And at that point, I'm normally elbowing my partner awake in the middle of the night saying, I just don't think I can be a writer.
Is at that point you suddenly start noticing the deck of the boat you're on has got leaks, and this is not going to make it across
it's
the
worse
Atlantic.
Than that.
This
it's
has
worse.
Got serious structural
I noticed
problems.
That the whole thing's on fire and there are sharks circling, and I say I can't be a writer and I can't be a teacher of writing, because what, you know, it would be completely hypocritical, so I'm going to have to resign, which means we can't pay the mortgage anymore, so we'll probably be homeless and then die quite soon. And he does always go, this is where you're at. And that is reassuring to know that when you have lost sight of land behind and in front and the raft is on fire, that someone else has seen you do this before. That's really reassuring.
Thank you to Jen for joining us. Thank you for listening. You can find out about the podcast at Unsound Methods on Twitter. Or unsoundmethods.co.uk.
You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
And you can find about my writing at jamiebatchin.com, at jamiebatchin on Twitter, at jamie_batchin on Instagram. And we will put information about where you can read more about Jen and her writing in the notes below this episode. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.